Welcome to the Tipsy Archives. This is Rachel Liggy, and I am here with my friend Michael Elliott. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You did a podcast with me a couple years ago now, I think.
It was a while, yeah.
Yeah. We talked about Socrates.
We did, yeah.
Yeah, so welcome back.
Thank you.
Today we are going to stick with kind of the subject of philosophy, as that's your jam.
Yeah, philosophy and religion in general.
Mm-hmm. So when I asked you what you wanted to talk about, you said you wanted to come tell me the story of Buddha.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite religious stories because it's, I don't know, it like when I first heard the story of the Buddha and like how he became the Buddha, it really kind of spoke to me in a way that few other religious stories did. Like stories about Jesus and Muhammad always feel a bit like I was learning about robots, like very passionless, very like predetermined, destined paths that didn't feel like people I could relate to.
Well, with a lot of those, like, kind of Abrahamic stories, like, this, they're so similar.
Yeah, totally.
And repetitive. So, but on the topic of religion, I mean, that's, I know, like, we're going to talk about sort of the origin story of, what's his name?
Buddha?
No, the guy.
Oh, like his name?
Siddhartha,
yeah.
Yeah,
sorry.
Totally gaffed on his name. Siddhartha Gautama. So we're going to talk about his origin story, and then, of course, Buddhism splits off into, like, a bunch of different directions.
Yes, like most religions do.
But you, so you're using the word religion. I know not all people, like, everyone would use the word religion, like...
To describe Buddhism? I suppose, yeah. There are some less spiritually robust versions of Buddhism out there, I suppose. Because you can kind of separate the practice of Buddhism from its more mythical, transcendental, kind of ontological elements, if you want, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, the context I learned about Buddhism was through religious studies, so I was kind of...
Right, that
such.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
I guess in my mind, coming from studying so much Western religion, I mean, like, Buddhism doesn't have the same sort of, like... You have to do this, or this will happen. You know, like, you have to have these beliefs, or you'll go to hell. Like, it doesn't have that sort of element to it as a religion. Also, Buddha's not a god. Well, I guess, actually, that depends on which form of Buddhism you're talking about.
Yes, and which kind of stories of Buddhism you want to talk about.
Yeah.
Because, like, for example, the story I'm going to tell is a bit more of a non-mythical version of events.
Mm.
Because, you know, when we talk about the story of Buddha, you can start with, like, his past lives, which he lived as, like, an elephant, and, like, different divine beings before he decided he wanted to become the Buddha and be awakened.
Right, because there's a story, like, kind of mythologically, that his mother was impregnated by an elephant?
I'm not sure. There is some tomfoolery with how his mom becomes pregnant in some versions of the story, yes.
So Siddhartha, I meant to look this up and ran out of time. Do we know if he's a real historical person?
I don't know. I don't think there is... particularly strong evidence.
So it's kind of in the same Jesus camp where it's like there isn't any proof, but like he could have been or could have been based on a few strong contenders.
Like if he is not a real historical person, there is a pretty big vacuum where there would be a couple people that would fit that bill. Like we do know that it wasn't until about 300 years or so after the Buddha's death that his followers started to write stuff down.
Mm-hmm.
Because most of it had been, as it was during his time, for the oral tradition. So, much like, you know, the Gospels of Jesus, there is quite a long gap in between when people started to get the story straight.
Right. So why don't you kind of start at the beginning of Siddhartha's life for me and tell me what it's all about?
Sure, yeah. So, we begin our story in the 6th century BCE. The exact dates of his birth and death have been in contention. But he lived somewhere in the middle of the 6th century, and we're in the Ganges Basin in India. Yeah, so it's a time of political and spiritual, let's say turmoil, but there's a lot of change happening. So this part of the Ganges is kind of changing from kind of lineage-based societies to more like a monarchy kind of structure. You have a lot of, like, kings taking up territory that used to be kind of like republics of of powerful people in the warrior class.
And we're talking about which area?
The Ganges Basin.
Okay.
The Middle Ganges.
So today what would be northern India?
Yeah.
Kind of area?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Because his birthplace is what is now Nepal.
Or
the so-called birthplace.
Yeah, I know the name of the town that was associated with his family. Yeah, Kapilavastu was the town that his family kind of ran. I don't know what that became or if it's still a thing. But yeah, it was in the foothills of the Himalayas, so it could be where mm-hmm. Nepal is now.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
Well, I think that it is, so okay. I'm going to confirm that as fact.
Awesome. Glad we had to take a hard stance on facts here on this podcast.
Yeah, super professional, well-researched podcast.
So yeah, we're starting to see the birth of monarchies that would start to turn into like the first Indian empires down the road. And we're also seeing the traditional Vedic religion starting to be challenged by new ideas. So right now, in the time of Siddhartha, there are social classes, so we have kind of the Brahmins at the top, who are like the priests, and they are leading sacrificial rites. They kind of say what is proper in the religion. It is through them that people study and learn about the Vedic tradition. And Siddhartha himself is going to be born to the warrior and ruler class.
So I was listening to a podcast earlier, which I don't know if you listen to, Philosophize This.
I don't.
It's a good, and I haven't listened to a lot of it, but it's a good overview of ideas and, you know, people and in the history of philosophy. So I kind of went and listened to the one on Buddha just as a sort of
Familiarize yourself.
Yeah, refamiliarize myself. And one thing that he was talking about was, like what you just said, like how there was kind of a disenchantment happening at the time, spiritually. And I think there's so many people that were so poor and were suffering that even like praying to the gods or whatever they were doing wasn't rewarding anymore. So there was a spike in asceticism or people becoming ascetic because they're just like, shit, like my life sucks. So I might as well just go and like wear a robe and practically starve myself anyway.
That's true. And like to perhaps find some kind of spiritual solace in that because unlike the Vedic tradition, which is basically like you have your place and you can be reborn into a higher class, things could be better for you in the next life, especially if you give to, you know, the Brahmins and practice the rites and be nice and heterodox. But there is a growing class. There's both like a growing middle class of like merchants and like wealth in the area, and we start to see like coins starting to become a thing. And yeah, we have these ascetics, these, you know, samanas, wandering monks who are practicing all sorts of different new religious traditions that are more focused around breaking out of the cycle of death and rebirth.
Yeah.
Like you said, they want some kind of spiritual solace now and not have to wait. It's because, you know, they're poor, they're sick, there is a rising merchant class that they don't get to see the fruits of that. But they do get to see the fruits of it because people are more able to give alms and support these people who want to wander around and find enlightenment. So you have different spiritual movements like the Jains and the Ajivikas becoming popular at this time. And more you just see a lot of wandering monks passing by trying to say, okay, whose dharma, whose teachings do you follow? Because there's lots of different competing beliefs and lots of people questioning the Vedic traditions. And this is the world that Siddhartha gets born into.
And I know you're going to get into this, but he doesn't see any of this.
Very true,
for
yes.
For a long time.
Yes. Buddha's father, which I'll call him Siddhartha, because he's not technically the Buddha yet, because Buddha means awakened one. His father is named Suddhodana, and he is a Raja, or like a chieftain of this place called the Sakyan Republic, basically a small...
I'm really glad that the heat finally went off, so yay, the sound will be better for a little while until the heat kicks back on.
it's a republic of people in the Himalayan foothills. The prominent town is Kapilavastu, and a lot of versions of the story tend to say Siddhartha is a prince, but that's technically not correct. Like, his father isn't a king. He's a Raja. He's kind of part of this republic of states that all kind of share responsibility and share decision-making, but he is a member of the ruler-warrior cast, he is going to, he has a very privileged life, and he's going to have that from
It's
the
true that doing research, you do see prints a lot.
You do, yeah.
And I guess that they're just trying to quickly say, you know, he's really well off.
Yeah, he's well off.
His dad's really important.
He probably would have been a Raja. Like, it's like being the son of a prime minister. Like, you're not going to get that position, but...
Unless you're Justin Trudeau.
True, exactly. You're not going to get that position by right, but you have a much better position than most other people do.
Right.
So, when Siddhartha is born... something that was very common at the time was to look for signs of what kind of person he's going to be. So you present your child to Brahmins, and they will look for signs on their body, kind of like divination. I was like, okay, this person is going to be this kind of person or this kind of person. And overwhelmingly...
This baby will be a Subway sandwich artist.
Yes.
Major disappointment.
But luckily for Siddhartha, overwhelmingly the opinion is that this is going to be an incredible person.
Hmm.
However, as most portents go, there's some ambiguity to what they tell the Raja. They say, your son, if he sees nothing but the fruits of your kingdom, if he sees nothing but prosperity and good fortune, he will be an incredible leader. However, if your son sees the more... negative parts of the world, if he sees suffering, if he sees anything untoward with existence, he'll become an incredible spiritual leader.
It's interesting, though, because you think to be an incredible political leader, you'd also need to see the suffering as well. But I'm not a spiritual leader of this clan. What did you call them? My fucking brain right now just like won't hold on to any information. I'm like literally in the middle of writing papers and just got through midterms, so like I think I'm just not even functioning.
The priests?
Yeah.
The Brahmins, sorry,
yes.
Yeah.
I'm not a Brahmin, so I don't know how this goes, but I would think that for any successful position, you would need to see both.
Yeah, but I think like in the context here, like, the Brahmin class, like, they have their meals specially prepared for them. They live a life very removed from the rest of the world. So it makes sense that, like, to be part of that ruling class, you would not come into contact with a lot of the lower class, especially, like, the untouchables and stuff, which will be a factor in Siddhartha's story going forward. But yeah, there is a kind of sense of the purer life you have, the better you are going to be off in this world and the next. That contact with suffering and stuff like that kind of lessens your soul at some point, which
seems
is part...
like such a foreign concept to my worldview right now.
Which is kind of part of what Siddhartha is going to rebel against.
Yeah.
So
okay.
It's a good preview of things to come. So his father gets this news and is understandably concerned. He has worked his whole life to secure the Sakyan clan and its holdings. And he wants, you know, someone to replace him and continue the work he has done for most of his life. He wants a good, not necessarily heir, but someone who can help expand their territory, expand wealth for their people. And so he sets about on this project to make sure his son doesn't want for anything. He basically creates this artificial utopia inside the palace. He finds the best teachers for his son. He surrounds him in drummers, in courtesans, in, you know, practicing different aspects of rule. So he's familiar with farming techniques. He's familiar with combat. He's familiar with anything the Raja can put in front of him.
Okay, so at least he's educating him and not just spoiling him.
Oh, yeah, totally. But he is having, like, the best life you can. One of the best lives you could probably hope for in this time period. Like, Siddhartha wants for nothing because the Raja, his father, wants to make sure he's going to replace him someday.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least become a great ruler. Which makes sense because a lot of, like, I'd imagine at this point when you imagine a great spiritual leader, like, a lot of those people basically look like homeless people at this point. Like,
right.
They don't eat a lot. They don't bathe. They live very... hard, odd lives, and it's basically saying, okay, your son can become a great politician or he become a hippie.
It's which like would your you weird like for uncle. This?
Yes,
started
exactly.
Hanging out with a cult.
So there's not much of a contest in the Raja's mind as to what he wants for his son.
Yeah.
And this continues for most of Siddhartha's life. He finds a wife. He has a son. He is 29 before any of this part of his world changes at all.
His wife is probably super hot.
Yeah, for sure. His kid is probably adorable. But yeah, he gets to be 29 years old and starts to question the world as it has been presented to him. Again, the story, different versions of the story kind of split on how this happens. It could be that, you know, little godlings or different versions of Startha have kind of, like, planted this moment to happen. Or it could just be, like, when you have a great education and you have, you know, you can start to doubt the world around you, especially when there is a lot of new ideas floating around the territory at this point. And so his father can see his son is starting to get anxious and antsy and isn't interested in the dancing girls anymore, isn't interested in the familiar distractions that have been put in front of him.
Well, the story that I've come across in my research a couple times is the one that he's kind of like, as he gets older, he starts to wander around the city more, or I guess the area he's living in, and like in a carriage of some kind.
Yes.
And that, are you heading towards that?
We are, yes. Okay. So, there's a couple versions of this story. What I saw recently was that Siddhartha's father kind of sets up, like, a reverse parade for his son, where, like, the rest of the town gets dressed up for him so he can go out and see parts of it that he's never seen before. Mm-hmm. But his father's still very much like, okay, don't see anything bad here. Just, like, everyone, you know, on your best behavior and stuff like that, so he can parade his son and show him new sights and stuff.
I just don't really think this is healthy.
I know, right? It feels very strange. But yeah, the version that I like...
It's like the original Truman Show.
Yeah, totally. You're awakening from a dream. And this is very much a dream. There's also an allegory to, you know, like... I don't know if we talked about this in the Socrates episode, but like Plato's cave. And like you're experiencing a world that feels real, but it's just shadows and echoes of the more real world that is outside the cave.
Yeah.
But yeah, a lot of that is... very common in these kind of religious biographies of prophets and founders of religions. But the version of the story I like is that Siddhartha goes to his charioteer, his driver, basically, a man named Chana, and says, I want you to show me around the town outside the palace that I've never seen before. Which puts Chana in this impossible position where, right. Like, his boss basically is telling him, hey, please, friend, break this one rule that the Raja has, like, forbade you and any other staff of the palace to do. Mm-hmm. Show me the outside world. And Chana, bless him, says, okay, Siddhartha, I'll send you out, so...
So do they, like, do this in a way that the people wouldn't recognize that he was in, like, a royal carriage sort of situation?
Yeah, so like I said, some versions of the story say it's, like, it's very obvious, but Siddhartha managed to see some cracks in the facade in the common people. Some are like, he does it in secret and like enlists Chana to be his co-conspirator and like secrets him out the palace for a couple nights, which is the version of the story I like because it makes Chana much more like, puts him in this kind of like funny, impossible position where he's trying to be a good friend and also not get like thrown in prison forever for breaking the rules of the Raja.
Do we know what happens to him?
Yes.
Just give me all the spoilers right
now. He gets off pretty light in versions of the story I've seen. Like,
he doesn't get like quartered and murdered.
No.
It's not bad.
Actually, the Buddha's horse gets worse off. There's versions of the story where like the horse that's pulling the chariot dies of heartbreak immediately when Siddhartha leaves.
Yeah, I heard that. But yeah, knew horses were so sensitive.
Yeah. Very much so. But no, I think Chana...
And then he gets to become, like, kind of a god, right? The horse?
Yeah, a lot of people in Siddhartha's inner circle become, like, the versions of, like, saints or, like, reach their own kind of levels of enlightenment after the fact. They're all spiritually kind of well-regarded and well-taken care of.
Or are just written into some good stories.
Yes, that could also just be hogwash. We don't know. So, yes, Siddhartha... enlists his friend Chana to take him outside the palace. Mm-hmm. And on this journey, they're, you know, going down the road. Chana is probably praying or something that just nothing's going to go wrong so he can keep his job. And that's when Siddhartha sees someone who is sick. just someone who has, you know, the flu or something and is, you know, is pallid, sweaty, obviously in distress. And Siddhartha turns to his friend Chana and says, what's wrong with that person? And again, Chana's put in this very weird position where he has to explain to his 29-year-old friend, what does it mean when someone gets sick?
Yeah, because they've shielded him from all of this.
Yeah, he is very ignorant of large swaths of human experience at 29 years old. And so Chana says, well, that person is sick. They are unwell, and they will probably get better, but most people do get sick at some point. And Siddhartha says, well, even me? And Chana's like, yes, everyone, you know, health does not last. This is ephemeral. And Siddhartha's understandably puzzled by this. Like, imagine going for most of your life and never knowing someone can get sick.
Yeah, it'd be pretty hard to wrap your head around.
Yeah, like, never understanding you can feel worse than you do day to day. Like, it's just like a bar graph that's always going up or, like, staying level. So Chana quickly hurries Siddhartha back into the palace without no one else the wiser. And then Siddhartha says to him, we have to do this again. And Chana just kind of, like, grins and says, of course, my friend. Mm-hmm. Like, unable to say no to basically his boss. And so they go out again for a second journey into the town. And on this one, Siddhartha sees someone who is old. They have wrinkly skin, they are hunched over, they are moving slowly. And again, Siddhartha asks his friend Chana, what's wrong with that person? And Chana has to break the news to his friend that people in the world get old.
Why is that person so shriveled?
Yeah, that health and vitality is not everlasting. That is also going to be a future that that Siddhartha is going to have to contend with at some point. And again, Siddhartha is understandably shocked by this revelation.
Like, so I wonder if he has grandparents. Or if they just look really good. Or they just told them they went to go live somewhere else.
Yeah, I imagine probably the latter, since the Raja was very meticulous in this scheme of his to make sure his son saw no bad things in the world.
I know that I shouldn't ask these questions about mythical stories, but...
Yeah, I mean, that's good. I mean, they're not meant to be airtight. They're meant to be, you know, communicate the different psychological and emotional truths of the people going through them, but it's still fun to nitpick sometimes. So, Siddhartha asks for yet another journey, and Chana just kind of grins embarrassed and says, okay, sure, we'll go out again. Like, probably, like, starting to put some money aside in case, like, this whole charioteering thing falls through.
Yeah, I think he probably just assumes that he's screwed at this point.
Yeah, at this point. He's trying to get on Siddhartha's good side.
So he can't put the genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, totally. So if his father does come for him, he's like, I was following orders. So yeah, they have a third visit to the local town, and at this point, Siddhartha sees a funeral procession. He sees a dead body, and once more asks his friend, what happened? And again, Chana is in this awful position where he has to explain to his adult friend what death is.
That is not in his job description.
No. And like a really difficult conversation. Like, if I... Imagine you having to explain to me what death is right now. Like, somehow I have never encountered that in my life whatsoever.
I would probably change the subject.
Right? Like, that is a heavy load to bear.
And then what happens? Like,
well... Yeah, so Chana says that person died, and you start to ask, is that going to happen to me? Is that going to happen to my family? And Chana says, yes, that is... Fate of all things is to die, and if Chana is, you know, part of the Vedic tradition, he probably says you'll be reborn as something else according to your karma. If you did good deeds, you'll be ascending to a higher state of being and have a much better life than you had now.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and Siddhartha is again shook by all this. He has a lot to process. Until now, he has never known a life that had any pain, that had any suffering, that had any sort of negative consequence to it, and now suddenly he is in a world that has death, old age, and sickness.
If you don't have suffering, I don't mean to get philosophical here, maybe I do, but if you have like this life of riches and easiness and concubines and food and beer and whatever, how could you realize that these things are great? I guess they're just every day.
Yeah.
It seems like you would think that that life could be a boring life.
It could, but I think that's part of the reason why these journeys start, right? Is because when that settles into being the status quo, eventually you just can't up it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start to get restless. You start to look for new experiences, right?
And he does have teachings around these ideas later that if we talk about, I want to comment on because I like them. But for now, I will let you go on.
Thank you. So yeah, I think at this point, China's probably thinking, okay, I've scared him enough. He's been scared by the world enough. I don't have to go on any more of these trips where I'm risking my livelihood and my family. I'll be fine. But no, Startha comes to him again one more time and says, I have to see more. And so they get inside their chariot. China takes him outside, and this time Startha has a very different experience. He sees one of these wandering ascetics, these monks, who have nothing on them but like some very simple clothes, probably a robe, and an alms bowl, something they use to collect food so they can keep going.
So, for anyone who doesn't know, like, ascetics or asceticism is like when you deny yourself most things in life, I guess. I mean, you have the very bare minimum diet, you don't care about money, like you see it in Western Christian monks, you see it in Eastern monks, any like really extreme religious, seeking the highest points of spirituality because you've shed all of these extra things from your life. I don't know if you have more to add to that.
Yeah, no, totally. And again, in some versions of the story, they're not specifically an ascetic monk. They could just be like a wandering monk who might not be practicing that form of spiritual enlightenment.
I mean, like, not saying that you're never going to drink alcohol or smoke or have sex. I mean, those would all be like ascetic practices.
Yeah, totally. But as we'll see, as Startha goes out into the world, like, there are traditions that take that to the absolute extreme or to try to get enlightenment or a higher state of being.
Mm-hmm. And I will talk more about that later.
Yes, absolutely. basically Buddha or Siddhartha sees this man who seems calm and serene and has nothing. And Siddhartha asks his friend Chana, who is this person that seems to not realize the world has these awful things in it? And Chana says, well, that is one of the wandering, spiritualists. This is a monk who is trying to find a way out of this world through enlightenment. And suddenly, Siddhartha has a plan. Because he has seen that the world has these awful qualities to it, that existence entails suffering, which before these journeys he has never had to consider. So in some point, like, these aren't natural states of being in his mind. These are problems to solve.
Right.
Because he's not encountered them until such a late point in his life. He's like, okay, well, life doesn't necessarily have to be this way, because he has known a life that's been freed from all that. And now he sees this wandering monk and starts to think, okay, maybe I am not doomed to be sick and to grow old and to die. Maybe there's a better way. Maybe there's a different path than this. And he gets it in his head that maybe that is the life he should be pursuing, a way to avoid all these awful things that he now realizes are an indelible part of life.
You have to imagine that when he decides to go the hardcore ascetic route, he has really no idea what he's getting himself into. I mean, I would assume, because he's like, this is a, like, I, at this point, probably kind of a romantic idea, but like something that's so different from the life that he knows. And I, like, it seems like from the stories, he commits to it.
Yeah.
But like, it'd be hard to imagine that he really can fully grasp what that's going to entail.
Yeah, it's true. And yeah, the stories about him, like, his path to enlightenment takes around 6 years, as the stories go, from the moment he decides to leave the palace to becoming enlightened.
That would make him around my age.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
Spooky.
I'm almost enlightened.
So yeah, he... there are some other moments that help drive home the point that this life isn't for him anymore. There's a story about how, like, he gets surrounded by dancing girls, and, you know, having had these journeys, he's no longer interested. He kind of dozes off, and the women all kind of take the night off and doze off as well, and he wakes up and realizes that, you know, all their makeup is smudged and they're all in disarray. It's like, oh, this is all just, you know, a fantasy I've been fed, basically. And yeah, at some point he just resolves, okay, I'm going to become one of these wandering monks. I'm going to leave this entire life behind. I'm going to leave my wife and my infant son in the middle of the night without so much as a goodbye.
So before we turned the microphone on earlier, we were kind of talking about Siddhartha and how, obviously there's all the good things that you can say about a story and that he becomes the Buddha, but not everything is necessarily great, and how it's, there's not, you know, there's people in the story that, suffer from his choices, and, you know, namely his wife and his kid.
Yeah, and the majority of his family, actually, as we'll see going forward, because, yeah, the Siddhartha basically tortures himself to find enlightenment, and, like, his family aren't in ignorance of that. Like, his father's a powerful man and sends people to look after him, and the reports they get back are not great. But, yeah, Siddhartha basically decides he's going to go live this life as a wandering intellectual trying to find enlightenment, and starts that by abandoning his family. Without even saying what he's doing.
So, although, you know, he gets to a place of enlightenment, he starts out in a place of kind of being real self-centered.
Yeah, I was talking to you about this before we started. It was kind of like, versions of the story kind of sound like a rich, middle-aged man going through a midlife crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much a man finding enlightenment. Like, It's kind of the exact playbook. It's like, oh no, my life's been a lie at this point. I need to go and find myself.
I need to buy a sports car. I need to starve myself under a fig tree.
Yeah, yeah.
Something.
Yeah, it's. You can read this story as kind of like the most accidentally successful midlife crisis.
Yeah, did he just like luck into becoming a spiritual leader because he was rebelling against his life? Or is he really, you know... Did he really figure it all out? Because he was on such a path.
Yeah, which if we follow like kind of the traditional Buddhist mythological account of this, like it's the fact that he was predestined to do this. Like he set out to do this. His past life set him up for this moment. The rest of the pantheon was kind of setting things up for things to be this way. But I kind of like this version of the story better.
So at this point, he does go off and becomes a very ascetic monk type dude.
Yeah,
he goes out and hangs out with like a bunch of other ascetic monk type dudes.
Yeah, he leaves the palace. He leaves all his jewelry behind with his driver, who kind of like takes him to the outskirts of their territory.
Oh, he cuts off his hair.
He cuts off all of his hair. Yeah.
That's a big thing, I think.
It is. And yeah, basically just has simple clothes and starts walking to the nearest settlement and to beg for alms. And, yeah, spends the next about 6 years practicing different meditative and ascetic traditions to try to jumpstart his brain into enlightenment, into nirvana, and trying to find a way out of this problem of existence. Because in the world as he understands it, in the Vedic tradition, like, if you die, that's not it. You will come back as something else. You will continue to exist. Your karma keeps pushing you forward. And so what he's looking for is a solution to existence, if you would consider it a problem. So the problem being, we are alive, we are suffering, and there is no way to stop that suffering.
Right. But he's trying to, at this point, find a way around that.
Yes, he is trying to find a solution to suffering in life. And so he starts by finding different communities of these wandering spiritualists.
Which is really kind of a little rich boy perspective, too, isn't it?
Kind of, yeah, but at this point, like, it is definitely a perspective, but at this point, like, he has nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he is living day to day, begging for food, finding shelter where he can, and again, like, the story doesn't let up on that fact. They drive home to the point, like, he is walking every day. Like, he is not used to that. He is not used to food that has not been specifically prepared for him.
I wonder how many times he was like, this is a bad idea. I regret...
Probably a lot.
I regret my choices.
But again, like, he has had such an odd life that has given this perspective that allows him to think of of the status quo as we know it, as life as we know it, as a problem to solve.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the end of the day, if he goes back to his old life, it's just going to be more of the same, right? He's still going to be disenfranchised. He's still going to not want this existence in a weird way. It's kind of hard for most modern people to understand, I would think. But
so what changes?
So he goes to one community of monks that teach him meditation rituals and techniques.
And they're like, eat 3 grains of rice a day or something.
Yeah. They aren't as strict as the communities we'll find later. This community is more about trying to achieve higher states of being through meditation, through repetition of mantras and stuff like that.
Do they do drugs?
I don't know. I would assume not, but I can't say for sure.
Mm.
There is probably a really cool, like, 80s version of this story that is like a psychedelic trip through different hippie communities that I would really love to see now that I'm talking about it. Like a Mandy-esque version of Startha's life would be really cool. I haven't seen that,
but I've heard good things.
Mandy's fantastic.
Okay. It's on my list.
So yeah, he exceeds at this. He is very good at meditating. He's very good at picking up this. He is surpassing his teachers in just a few years. But the problem persists. Like, he is achieving higher states of being and consciousness, but he's still here. He is still existing in the world. He still has to come back and eat something or sleep. He has not solved the problem of existence yet. And so he leaves that school of thought, travels around some more, and then he finds this group of ascetics who are trying to attain similar results, but instead of meditating, they do it through denying themselves things like food or oxygen and stuff like that. So he starts practicing
this method. Yeah, they're trying to breathe as little as possible.
Yes, so he described...
These guys sound really fun.
Yeah, they're into some stuff. So yeah, the stories describe him as, you know, holding his breath until his ears were ringing and he was basically passing out. He was eating, like I said before, like 1 pea a day, basically. Mm-hmm. And his body was becoming emaciated and sunken, and you could see his spine from his front and stuff.
I'm just
like
going to have an opinion here. That's too much.
Yeah?
That's going too far. That's not helping anyone. But I guess it helped him achieve the polar opposite of where he had been.
Yes. So, again, he does very well, as religious figures often do in whatever they steep themselves in these stories.
What a keener.
Yes. He surpasses his teachers. He is achieving higher states of awareness. But the problem persists. He keeps coming back to life, and he is not finding any enlightenment. He is not finding the solution to his problem. And so he gets up, which at this point, being so emaciated, is a very difficult thing for him to do. But he leaves that community, takes his old alms bowl, and a woman sees him and gives him rice milk, and which he eats. And I don't know if you've ever gone through a long period of not having food and then having a meal, but that is one of the best meals you will ever have.
I mean, like, last week I had to fast to get some blood tests done, and I had a hamburger afterwards, and it was great.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, the first meal you have after not having to eat for a while is, like, it doesn't matter what that is. It could be just a handful of pine nuts, and those pine nuts are the best pine nuts you have ever tasted.
Mm-hmm.
So, Startha, already in kind of a heightened state of consciousness for having this incredible meal after having basically nothing for years, says to himself, okay, I've gone one way. I have meditated and meditated. I have denied my body all these things. I'm just going to sit underneath this tree by the side of the road, and I'm not leaving here until I get my answer. And so he meditates. And for whatever reason, could have been these two very disparate paths he came down. Could have been it was set up by the gods and past versions of himself.
I'm assuming there's a story somewhere where this woman with the rice milk is some kind of divine intervention.
I'm not sure. Probably. I've not seen that version of the story. I think things go well for her after this moment because she basically helped the Buddha become the Buddha in ways that, you know, a lot of other people that were central in the story didn't. But yeah, could have been the fact that he just had an incredible meal after having not eaten anything of substance for a very long time. But the Buddha achieves enlightenment, becomes the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes that the solution to existence is, the solution to his problem is that he wanted it so badly. That desire was the thing that was keeping him from achieving enlightenment.
And Buddha means the awakened one?
Yeah.
So he levels up.
Yeah, that's actually a really good way of putting it. Yeah, he achieves the highest level. He awakens from this dream of existence, is the way of putting it. And yeah, basically he comes to several realizations. It doesn't all happen at once. He kind of stays meditating there for several days. There is also, in the mythical version of this, there is a battle with Mara, the illusionist, the sort of Satan-esque part of Buddhist mythology that kind of tempts him and assaults him with armies representing the different parts of the world and the elements that he staves off to achieve enlightenment.
Sort of like the Jesus goes into the desert, yes, and is tempted by Satan.
Yes, very much so.
Kind of thing.
Yeah. But yeah, he finds this middle path of not denying yourself, not, you know, trying to achieve higher states of awareness, but acknowledging that this world is transient, that nothing is permanent.
Mm-hmm.
Acknowledging that there is suffering in the world, and then finally acknowledging that the self is not special, that it is not a permanent thing, that it is made of all these different phenomena and heaps, that themselves are not necessary to the being, that the self is just as transient as the breeze, and that if you can achieve that kind of understanding, then you break free of the cycle of death and rebirth, and existence no longer becomes painful.
So the only things we're certain of is that you are going to be born, you're going to suffer, and that you're going to die. Everything else is change, shifting, unpredictable.
Yeah, even the self. Like, the self you are now is not the self you were 5 minutes, 1 second, 10 years ago.
Thank God.
Yeah. And it will persist. Like, there is no part of you that is you. It is all just transitory nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have to understand that in order to achieve nirvana.
Hmm. I'm into it.
Me too.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that is the story of the Buddha. I have left out a lot of stuff.
So actually, it's funny. I'm just going to reach over here for my bullet journal.
I've done a lot of editorializing, but...
I recently, because I mentioned to you I'm taking this class about Chinese calligraphy and painting and all this stuff, so I was like doing a little bit of research on Buddha, and I had made this page in my journal about the Four Noble Truths, which is exactly what you're talking about. The first one being that life is full of suffering. The second one, that suffering is caused by desire. The third one is that you can eliminate some suffering by eliminating desire. And to do that, you have to follow the Eightfold Path,
yes,
which is to have right views, right conduct, right mindfulness, right aspirations, right livelihood, right speech, right endeavors, and right meditation. So I'm going to, obviously, we could talk way more about that. I mean, there's so many teachings that Buddha had. And like we already mentioned, it does then continue to really split off in a lot of different directions as it spreads to China, throughout India and Sri Lanka, and just, you know, so many areas, Japan, etc. Yeah.
Zen Buddhism.
And then eventually we get really cool kung fu movies.
Sure, yep.
That came from Shaolin.
Okay, yeah, no, that's, yeah, yeah. Okay, nice.
It's a logical path.
I didn't follow you at first, now I understand where you're coming from. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so I wanted to kind of, like, you came here to tell me the story of Buddha, which I heard a little bit before, but, you know, you gave me a much more fleshed out version, so that, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And I wanted to talk about something more extreme, and we kind of spent a lot of time talking about the ascetic side of spirituality and Buddhism, and so I'm gonna tell you about one guy whose name is Lama Itigolov.
Okay.
And he is a very famous monk from the, I'm gonna mispronounce so many things here, sorry everybody, he was from a Buryat Buddhist tradition in Tibet. And He actually has a pretty interesting life story because he's born in 1852. I'm not really sure what his early life is like. I don't think we really have a lot of those records, but he rises throughout the ranks of the monastery that he's in and becomes a very important teacher. Apparently he wrote books on pharmacology, which is interesting. But then at some point he becomes a spiritual advisor for Nicholas II of the Romanov dynasty in Russia.
Wow.
I mean, and you have to keep in mind at this point, Nicholas II, who's the last Romanov czar, is like a really unstable individual and is searching for a lot of answers, especially because he's got a really sick son.
Yeah.
He's hanging out with Rasputin.
Yeah, I was gonna say this is the Rasputin guy, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely. But he's awesome. He's looking he also goes to like France and like areas of Europe and deals with like weird like spiritualist people.
Mm-hmm.
Like basically they're looking for anybody to give them answers because they're just these like confused, lost, unstable people. Not to say that that's why they go to this guy, Iti Golov, but he's bringing in all these spiritual kind of mentor.
Yeah.
Type people. And people who are listening, who have listened to previous podcasts, we talked about the Romanov assassinations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The end of the dynasty. So if you want to hear more about that family and how fucked up they are.
And Rasputin.
And Rasputin. We have a podcast all about that topic. But he ends up kind of hanging out with Nicholas II for a while. Iti Golov. Born Dashi Dorzo Iti Golov. Which is quite a name.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, like, the Romanovs, you know, are taken down. Lenin takes over the government. Before that happens, Iti Golov sets up the first Buddhist monastery in Moscow. Or no, St. Petersburg, sorry. Maybe Russia, I don't even know. But, like, he sets up, like, one of the first Buddhist temples there with the okay of Nicholas II. But eventually, years go by, the Romanovs fall, and in the 20s, he encourages all of the Buddhist monks to get out of Russia. I think he specifically says something like, don't become overwhelmed with the red teachings.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ominous.
So, yeah, it's 1927. He warns all the monks to leave Russia. So that's just kind of an interesting point of his life. And that's actually not even why I wanted to talk about him initially. I was just kind of like, whoa, that's a random kind of connection. But this guy, I would say he died in 1927, but like he may or may not have died because he was one of these guys who he knew that he was near the end of his life, and he called a lot of his disciples to him and said, let's start to do these rituals for, you know, the end of my life. And they didn't really want to do it, saying like, oh, you're not dead yet. Like, you know, we don't want to start these rituals with you. So he went off on his own and he kind of went into this meditation on his own. He quote unquote does die. And his wish that he's told his fellow monks is that he wants to be buried sitting in the lotus position. So they, like, put him in this box. Put him in a tomb, or... I don't think he's buried, like, in earth. He's, like, put away somewhere.
Yeah, like
a... In this box, sitting up.
Right.
And this is 1927. And then in 1955, they open up the box and he, like, has not showed any signs of decay. I mean, he doesn't look good.
Presumed not, yeah.
They come back again in 1973 and look, and he looks the same. And then again, they open up his tomb in 2002 and they have Buddhist leaders as well as also like scientists who are doing tests on him. Not like cutting him open and stuff, obviously, because they're like, what if he's alive?
Right.
He's not. Probably. I don't know.
Still, want to respect the body.
In case he's gone. So some of the, you know, some people who believe in, you know, that you can go into like a Buddhist meditative state that is like so intense that you're basically mummified, but you're still alive because you're so close to nirvana. You're like in that pre-nirvana stage that you just, I don't know, are like a slightly living mummy. And that's basically where he's at now. Like, but they didn't put him back in the box. Like, now he sits in, like, a clear...
Right, yeah, he's, like, on display.
He's on display. I have a picture of him somewhere. Which does not help the podcast listeners, but I will post something later on. But I will show you here. There's a picture of him in his box in a fancy outfit.
That's a very fancy outfit.
And it just
outfit,
looks like
yeah.
a, like a store display kind of thing.
Yeah, he looks saintly.
Also, like, I mean, this is he's not decomposed, but to me, and this is going to sound gross, but to me, his flesh looks like the consistency of, like, those rawhide dog treats.
Yep.
Because if you see, like, I'm showing you a picture here of him more naked in his sitting pose. He doesn't look like a healthy person.
No.
He looks super creepy. Now they have him kind of dressed up in robes in this really
But also, like, undoubtedly, like, not a skeleton.
No, not a skeleton.
And, like, not as decomposed as you should be.
No, just kind of, like, a little beef jerky-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, kind of.
That is not someone who has been dead for several decades.
No. So there's also this... Okay, so the weird thing about Ichigo Love as well, they keep him in this temple. Temple in Tibet. I'm not finding the name of it right now. But they keep him in this, like, famous, beautiful... Like, I have a picture of it. It's beautiful looking. I just can't find the name of where it is. And so recently, they have these security cameras around the temple. And they've claimed that when the temple's been completely locked up in the middle of the night, like, they'll catch... things on the security cameras, mm-hmm. like somebody moving around in the temple, and they're like, maybe his spirit is, like, awake at night and moving around the temple. And they released not, like, full-on moving footage, but, like, two still captures, and one of them just looks like a dude holding takeout bags. So
I mean, you spent that much time not eating, you might get a bit peckish.
You're gonna be pretty hungry.
Yeah.
So that's kind of weird. But regardless of what's really happening, there's this, like, kind of semi-mummified dude. And, like, you do see this in Catholicism, too, where they put the, old popes on display in these glass cases, and they dig them up after decades, and they haven't decomposed, quote-unquote.
Right.
But, like, it's always super shady, too, because then you dig deeper into it, and they're like, oh, yeah, no, he was super well embalmed, and then they just, like, waxed his whole body.
Yeah.
And somebody, it's a news source, has reported in the last few years that they just packed his body in salt, this guy.
Oh, wow.
The Lama Ichigo Love.
Well, that would do it.
So, maybe this guy is not legit, but there's way more cases of this kind of thing, too. The Japanese call it Soku Shinbutsu. I probably butchered that, sorry. It is believed that there's hundreds of monks who have trying to meditate themselves into mummification,
mm-hmm.
but only 24 such mummifications have been found. That's still quite a few.
They have I've read about this before, they have a system where, like, they'll have, like, a bell on a string,
mm-hmm.
and they'll ring it, they're supposed to ring it, like, once a day to say, like, hey, I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they just kind of wait for that bell to stop before they go into the final phases.
Yeah, the ones that are actively trying to do this, it's something like a 3,000-day process.
Yeah,
and for the first 1,000 days, like, they will eat, like, a very little. And then for the next 1,000 days, they only eat, like, tree scrapings.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the last, they don't eat at all. And then they just... I mean, I wonder how many people tried it and then they just died and turned into skeletons.
I don't know.
I want to see those records. There was another mummy that was found in Mongolia. Somehow the authorities were alerted to the fact that this guy had it in his house because he had stolen it from a cave and was going to sell it on the black market. And it was 200 years old. And it was another one of these seated, cross-legged... clearly sort of in a meditative pose, probably with some very decomposed robes on, if anything at all. And somehow he found it in a cave and smuggled it to his home.
I really want to know who's buying mummies on the black market.
Well, I mean, he didn't even get rid of it, so...
Maybe, I guess no one then, maybe, is the problem. Like, but, like...
Somebody would have.
Oh, wow. That's a level of...
And that mummy's, like, 200 years old.
Oof.
Yeah. And it, like I showed you, I just showed you the picture of the Itigolev one, which is 164 years old. I guess, like, including his birth date.
Yeah.
This one's even older, and he looks about the same. Whereas, like, he just kind of looks like his skin is really tough, and he's really withered, and he's kind of hunched over. Mm-hmm. But he definitely still has, like, skin and, like, hands and fingernails, and he's small. But, yeah. It's a thing. There's, like, a bunch of these cross-legged, lotus position, withered little, like, monks that some people believe they either did ascend or are in the process of ascending and aren't totally dead. But, yeah, that's kind of weird. Kind of creepy.
Yeah, it's kind of like an extreme edge of the meditation practice, isn't it?
Yeah, and I mean, like, we were talking all about, like, Siddhartha Buddha, and how he kind of went that extreme way of not eating and then came back from that and said, okay, like, actually eating sometimes is good. Because he's like, choose the middle way. But I don't know. I guess these guys are just saying, this is the next step before I reach that level.
Yeah. I mean, enlightenment isn't it's a difficult process to try to achieve, right? Like, there are multiple stages of transcendence. There's, like, nirvana isn't just, like, a one and done. Like, it is a lifelong process. You have, like, smaller enlightenments on your way to the big one. So there's a lot of different paths and options available once you decide you want to spend your life achieving that kind of thing.
So I wrote down in my notes here that when they pulled him out, Itigolev, in 2002, and they had scientists checking out his body, he was not decomposed past the point of somebody would be after 36 hours.
Wow.
And that had been since 1927. That's pretty weird.
Yeah, but also, I don't know.
Also, if these guys are not totally dead, I certainly hope at this point they don't wake up and have to deal with the state of their bodies now.
Yeah, or they've, you know, achieved a level of consciousness that doesn't bother them so much. That'd be nice.
Maybe they just have, like, have a bath and they'll just, like, reconstitute. They'll just, like, puff right back up. That's all I have to say about that.
Gotcha.
I kind of knew a lot of the really broad ideas of Buddhism that a lot of people probably know from movies or...
Yeah, just being alive in the world.
Being alive in the world. But doing a little bit more research about it recently and being in this sort of Chinese art class that I'm taking and learning a little bit more about it there. I mean, there's so many kind of ideas that I very much like and agree with, and that I don't find offensive. And one of the things we were kind of talking about earlier was just the idea of sort of being, not taking things for granted and being grateful, which was one of the teachings that I had come across. And in that podcast that I was listening to earlier, he kind of like tells the story about how he's like, if you brought a new car, the first day you bought the car, you'd be like, oh my God, this car is amazing. I'm so happy. But then, like, a year goes by, and you're like, yeah, my car's cool, like, but it's not like every time you see it, you're like, oh my God, yay, my new car.
Mm-hmm.
You just get used to it, and that happens in our lives. Like, Buddha thought, like, that happens. We get used to everything, and then we take it for granted.
Yes.
And that you should try to be continuously aware and kind of grateful, and that's definitely something that my life I think about a lot and definitely appreciate. So... from the really kind of cursory overview of Buddhism that I've had in the last week, there's a lot of good stuff there that resonates with me. It's not like I read about it and I'm like, this is cool, I'm going to do this now. It was more like I read it and I was like, yeah, this is the way I already feel, and I really feel good about that statement, you know?
Yeah, totally. Similarly, there's a lot of stuff in Buddhism about, like I said, being in the present moment, not trying to spend too much time in the past or present, to being aware of just your breathing. Because at the end of the day, meditation is basically just a exercise in trying to do one thing, and that's sitting, and how incredibly difficult that is.
I think, and I do enjoy, and I'm not terribly good at it, and I'm totally fine with that. Like, I do a little meditation here and there. I tend to do a little bit more sort of guided think about this thing as opposed to the think about nothing.
Yeah.
Sort of form of meditation, because it's easier to focus on a thing than not focus on a thing. And I hear people say, like, oh, I tried to meditate and I failed. I don't think you fail at meditation. I think you just kind of like go, okay, well, it was hard to clear my mind.
Yeah. It's easy to get dissuaded, I think, because it feels like something so simple that you should just be able to do, but we don't realize until we're in it that no part of our lives wants us to be still like that.
Yeah.
And that it's something like anything else. It takes, like any skill, it takes practice to do. Mm-hmm. But there are, you know, tangible benefits to it. Like there are incredible studies that have been done of, you know, high level Buddhist monks have been doing, you know, meditation for their whole lives and can, you know, warm their bodies to like, to the point where they can like dry a damp towel that's been draped over themselves. Like meditation is a very powerful exercise if you stick to it.
Yeah, I definitely, like for me personally, it's been worth it to, even just as a person who has some anxiety, just kind of taking moments at the end of my day to slow my brain down. That's been really great. And I know that's, you know, something that Buddha talked about was that when you do quiet yourself and meditate, like you always have that kind of this voice in your head, like nattering away at you. Like we're very self-involved people and our internal monologue is always going. Mm-hmm. And that's why we need to learn how to like quiet that down a little bit and remember that we are connected to so much more than just ourselves. So I've actually been going through, and this is by no means a dedicated practice. It's more of just kind of an interesting, like, light meditation focus I've been doing. That's like every month I've just been moving through each chakra. And this month I'm on the throat chakra. And it just means that when I have an extra moment, like usually, which is like when I'm in the bath or something like that, I will choose to kind of meditate through that lens where I'll focus on the things associated with that root chakra or that heart chakra or whatever. And it's just been a way to kind of familiarize myself with that practice and give myself a bit of a focus when I'm not sure what to focus on. So yeah, that's kind of something I've been doing for the last few months and it's been pretty cool.
Nice.
Yeah. So right now I'm on the communication expression throat chakra, color blue.
Cool. Sounds healthy.
Mm-hmm. I think that you and I should just have like this, our like philosophy, spirituality, religious series. We just like, I'll have you back every year and then we'll just talk about a different form of religion or something. I'd be down
for that, yeah.
And then I'll ask stupid questions about what's happening and yeah.
Cool. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for telling me about Siddhartha. Do you want to plug anything?
Sure. I'm a writer when I'm not doing other things that aren't writing. If you want to see some of my writing or support my writing, you can find me at patreon.com/notwriting. That's NOTRWRITING. I am kind of relaunching my Patreon soon, so that'll be the new address.
Cool.
So if you want to find cool stories I make or role-playing games I'm designing or whatever, you can find that there.
You are a game master. Game warden.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
You're the game warden. It's an official position.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, and thank you very much for everybody for listening to the Tipsy Archives. I know I haven't been posting content as often as I used to, so if you're still coming back and listening, thank you very much. If you want to email me, you can get a hold of me at thetipsyarchives@gmail.com. We are also on Twitter at Tipsy Archives, although I really don't use Twitter very often. And we have an Instagram page as well at Tipsy Archives. So once again, thank you very much. And I will see you next time. And Michael, thank you so much for coming. Cheers.
Thank you.